The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Today FM.
It all happens here.
As I think you know, we've been looking forward to the Dublin Web Summit here on this programme, particularly to the Founders event, where some of the most important people involved in technology in the world have come to Dublin over the last couple of days and are networking and discussing the future. And one of those who is in town is Jack Dorsey, who is the man who set up Twitter. It was his and others' idea, but he's the main man in Twitter. And today he appeared at the Trinity Philosoph, and I went down and I interviewed Jack Dorsey down there. So this is what happened.
Good to meet you, Jack. I just want to start saying I have a 7-year-old daughter who's a very stroppy individual who gives me a hard enough time as it is, and when she gets to the age where she'll be here in university or somewhere else, I think she'll be extremely difficult. But recently I was on this at home while she was talking to me, and she talks incessantly, and suddenly she shouted at me. She said, "Will you just put down that damn iPhone? You're always on Twitter and you're never talking to me." So she has copped my addiction very much in relation to Twitter. So I have to ask the man who has us all on Twitter, the man who founded it, just how addicted are you to your own product? How often do you use it?
Well, I would say that my mom is a lot more addicted than I am to the product. She loves getting updates nonstop because she lives very far away from where I live. And, you know, I typically call her about once every month.
Typical dutiful son, yes.
But every day, she finds, you know, what I'm doing and what I'm up to, and I have the same experience for her. But I think with any form of communication, I think Twitter is a new form of communication. We learn how to adopt to it. We learn what's useful and what's not useful, and what's distracting and what takes away from the rest of our lives. And Twitter is no different. You know, we need to find where it's comfortable, where it's valuable, and where we need to put it down.
How much time do you spend on it each day?
It really depends on the day. When I'm not in my normal context, not in my day-to-day life, I usually spend more time on it because I want to share what's happening around me and share, you know, what I'm seeing and what I'm experiencing with the people that are very far away. And then I also want to feel that sort of connection with what I know, which is, you know, just consuming and reading, you know, what's happening in the world. So in my day-to-day life, it's, you know, maybe 4 or 5 updates per day. And then when I'm traveling or when I'm doing something that I'm not typically doing, it's more like 10 or 20.
And what particularly do you like looking for? Who do you follow? What sort of things are you hoping to get?
I don't know. I follow about 900 people. I think what I like is a lot of variety. I like a lot of different opinion. I have people who are sharing exactly what they're doing during the day. I have people who are sharing opinions on world events. I have people who I've never met, who are in a remote area of the world that I want to learn more about, speaking in a language that I want to learn how to speak. So I use it as a tool to learn more about the world and specifically learn more about the people I care about and who I'm interested in. It's not just people, it's also organizations.
It's interesting that you talk about using it to learn, because the critics of Twitter, who often, I think, have never used it, seem to think it's about narcissism, it's about telling the world about you and things that are perhaps trivial. But what do you make of people who do it for that reason?
Well, I think the interesting thing about it is it's completely controlled by the recipient. So I am one of those people that update about eating breakfast. And I think, you know, 99.999% of the world could care less and may find it offensive. But my mom loves it.
And does she get in touch with you to say you're eating the wrong things?
Yes.
You need to be eating different things.
Yes, she has done that before. But the point is, she knows that I'm eating. She knows that I'm alive, and she can place herself in that context, you know. So it's that sort of message is extremely valuable to her. But a post or a tweet about technology or Silicon Valley is not so much. So she kind of like just ignores that stuff. So it really depends on the recipient, what interpretation they bring to the message. And that's what we have to remember, is that, you know, every single tweet is valuable to someone. Every single communication is valuable to someone. It's depending on the interpretation.
Where did you come up with the concept? Where did you get this idea of sending these text messages with a maximum of 140 characters?
I became obsessed with cities when I was about 15 years old, and I taught myself how to program so I could draw a map on the screen and I could play with the map. And my dream was to layer my room with massive screens of everything that was in the that was happening in the city. And my parents were they thought it was a nightmare scenario, but I kept driving forward, and I found these open databases of ambulances and taxis and police cars roaming about the city, and I could take that information and put them on the map so I could actually see what was happening in the city in real time. And I found that this practice was called dispatch. It's all these entities roaming about a city constantly reporting where they are and what they're doing. And I dedicated my life to writing dispatch software for some time until about 2000, when I realized that I had this gorgeous picture of the city and I could see it live and breathe, but there were no people on it. There were no citizens. My friends were not on it. Where were they and what were they doing? So I tried to build that system in 2000. It was the wrong time and the wrong team. But in 2006, SMS came to the United States. You all had it for 10 years prior to the United States. But it just started getting big, and we could go from carrier to carrier in the United States that year. And I fell in love with the technology, and specifically the constraint of 160 characters, because it allowed anyone with any cheap cell phone to participate in real time. And we took 20 characters away for a username, and we were left with 140 characters, and that's where the limitation came. But the idea came from that original desire to understand what was happening in the city and where people were and what they were doing.
So that's the motivation for that, very much, is giving somebody a tool with which to work. But then how do you marry that to a business concept and something that you have to raise funds for and something that you should make a profit out of?
Well, we've been spending the last 4 years figuring that out. I think with any technology like Twitter, your first driver is you want to see this in the world, and you want to see other people use it, and you want to use it every day. And if enough people use it, and if you build a large enough network, then there are ways to monetize it. And there are ways that not monetize it in an older way, but something that actually emerges from the network and the usage itself. And the company has been busy for the last year and a half discovering what those things are.
But how much interest is that to you, given that your background is in the development of the product? You clearly have a love of technology. So how difficult is it then to get the business angle and to become engrossed and actually try to make money out of it?
It's extremely interesting because the business angle sustains the technology. You can't have the technology persist without bringing in revenue and sustaining a company and a team around to build the technology. And, you know, a lot of people are driving towards a very successful future for Twitter, not just to put it out in the world, but financially as well. And I think it's one of the few companies that can have not only a major impact on the world, but a major financial outcome.
But how did you go about raising the money to develop Twitter? Because presumably you had to get substantial sums of money in to develop the product and the service.
We have some of the best investors in the world. You know, some of the best investors are very patient. They see the end vision. They see where the technology is going, and they see ways to monetize it, even though they were not immediately clear and a little bit foggy and misunderstood initially. And I think the biggest thing for any startup is not the overall business model, but the array of number of business models. Twitter could go down 100 different paths and monetize it 100 different ways, but there's only one that's going to sustain it and feel good to the network and also build the network even further.
And which one is that?
Well, I think what we're seeing is with the promoted products and the promoted trends and the tweets and the accounts, that it's something that feels very natural and feels like it's built into the system. And it just feels like another part of the Twitter experience. And that's exactly what you want to do. I mean, Google showed very clearly and crisply how a model can emerge from behavior. When you search on Google, you have an intent to find things on the iPhone, and that intent allows an ad or an introduction to an iPhone case manufacturer or to where you can buy the iPhone on the side to feel natural. And to basically inspire more people to go down that path.
You recently changed the interface on Twitter.com, updated it in the attempt to try and make some money out of it. How successful is that, and how much would you fear that perhaps people will reject the change, that they'll just want to stay with what they knew and won't move on to the new platform?
I think it was Twitter's most successful change. Like when we had two years into the company, we would change the color of the links and people would be up in arms and you know, declare that they would quit the service forever. So this one was an amazing overhaul of the UI, and it was specifically focused at surfacing more of the information onto one surface. So instead of having to click into a URL or click in to see a photo, everything is in one pane, and that's becoming increasingly important as people link to more different mediums that are not just contained within Twitter, but extend out to the entire internet.
How frustrating is it, though, to see that others are perhaps piggybacking on Twitter and they're offering their own platforms, particularly for use on things like smartphones, so that people don't go to Twitter.com necessarily? Something like a quarter of people on Twitter are using other applications.
Well, I think Twitter is best when it sparks an interaction. A lot of those interactions happen within Twitter. A lot of interactions happen outside of Twitter. And they happen on other clients as well. A lot of our growth and a lot of the ways that people have approached the system is because they could craft the experience themselves. They could define the experience for themselves. And a lot of the features that you see in Twitter that have made Twitter successful are from the users themselves. The retweets, the at replies, the hashtags, all invented by the users, not by the company. It was supported by the company, and we were very good listeners and editors of the features that the people wanted. But it all derived from the usage.
What do you make of celebrities who use Twitter now to promote products, that they get paid effectively for product placement in tweets? What do you think of that?
I don't know. That's a new behavior. When I hear that, I was doing an interview about 2 years ago, and just before I hopped on the interview, I said just because I tend to update about banal things, I said I'm having two Advil, and the guy immediately asked me, like, did you just get paid by Advil to tweet about that? And I said, no, I was just having some medicine because I have a headache and I'm about to do this interview. So it's been an interesting approach to, you know, what is sponsored and what is not. So I think Twitter is best when it makes organizations and governments and people and companies and especially anyone in the public eye more human. And I love hearing more of the personal aspect because it's more approachable. So I think anytime you mix in that sort of sponsorship, it takes away from that message and the potential to really understand.
Indeed,
that.
So if some celebrity decides then, because they've been paid by Advil or somebody else, to say that they're using that product, then does that cheapen them rather than cheapening Twitter?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really, Twitter is a utility and doesn't have a bias one way or the other. And again, it goes back to the interpretation. So if the interpretation of the people following you is that it cheapens your account or who you are as a person, then that's what it is.
Did you ever expect that Twitter would become so prominent in setting the news agenda, and that when things become, when they trend on Twitter, that other media are picking up on that and then saying, because that is popular, because that is of interest, that must be news?
I would actually like to see more of that. You know, we'd have this idea of a man on the street account for quite some time since journalism has been around, where journalists have gone out and talked to the people on the streets about what they thought about current events. And here we have a worldwide community updating in real time about everything that's happening. So a journalist can immediately approach it and get exactly what people are feeling about this particular product or this particular event or this particular area in real time. So I would love to see the journalistic discipline brought to that aggregate of opinions and really form a narrative around that. I don't think we've seen a lot of that, but the corpus of information that's happening and that's being published in real time is massive and needs to be edited and needs to be brought to us in a way that feels more like a cohesive narrative and a story.
You're listening to Jack Dorsey, the founder of Twitter, who was at the founders part of the Dublin Web Summit. And he was in the Trinity Philosoph today where I interviewed him. And we'll have more from one of the most influential men in world business after this. And the rest of our interview with Jack Dorsey at Trinity Philosoph today. In the time we'd left, I wanted to ask him about his new project Square. But first I asked him where he thinks Twitter is going to go. Does he think something will come along and perhaps usurp its popularity?
Well, I see Twitter as a communications tool. I see it as a new evolution of communications, and I see it as a utility. And as a utility, it constantly gets redefined by its users. And I think the future of it is we've made it very easy to put content into the system in real time, but getting stuff out, getting information out in a real time and relevant way is still very difficult. So building tools that allow us to filter in real time by location or by topic or by event, and also allow for some sort of discovery that you find information that's extremely valuable to you in that instant, is still very challenging and something we need to focus a lot of our energy on.
Yeah, how are you going to have the time and energy to do that when you've also got Square? Tell us about Square and how is this going to transform things?
Square is a... So 90% of the United States is paying with a plastic credit card. And only about 6% of the country can accept payments off those credit cards. So if you owed me $50 right now and all you had in your pocket was a credit card and you weren't carrying cash anymore, which no one in the United States carries, I would not be paid. So this is a little device that we're giving away for free that you plug into your smartphone or to your iPod or to your iPad, and it allows you to swipe a card through it and then put in an amount, and you sign with your finger, the payer signs with their finger, and then we give an email or an SMS receipt, and that all goes into my bank account that night. So anyone from a babysitter to a dog walker to a piano teacher to a tutor in school, to small businesses and large businesses, can now accept payments immediately from wherever they are without going through, without having to have a relationship with a bank. Just a simple free download and then a free.
And how developed is this now, and how much money have you got behind it?
We raised a Series A last year, so we've been working on this since February of 2009, and have been in a pilot program since January of 2010. And have sent out 50,000 of these devices. And last Friday, we opened the doors to the United States. We're starting with the United States because we have to go through a lot of banking regulation, and that banking regulation is very particular in the United States, but gets even more particular once you get outside of the United States.
It's not too particular here in Ireland, unfortunately. Okay, do we have any questions from the audience, please, for Jack? Gentleman here in front, we just get you a microphone. Thank you.
Other than those you've been involved in, what's your favorite website or web-based utility, and why?
Okay, let's see. That's a good question. I think the most interesting one to me right now is a company in New York called Kickstarter. It's a group-based financing tool. So anyone can decide that they want to, and they're focused a lot right now on art projects. So if I want to make a movie, I can write a synopsis and do a little video preview of what I intend to do, and then also give an amount of what I want to raise, and then people can come and help me raise that money by donating or gifting it. And then I can make that movie and show it right there. So it's a very interesting take on financing, and I hope eventually that, you know, we could explore those models with startups, because the hardest thing about starting a company is just getting off the ground and finding that original investment, that seed investment. We have a lot of angel investors in the world, but there are places that they're very hard to find and they're hard to get a hold of and get attention for. So that's been one of my favorites recently.
Hey, over here.
I'm just wondering, do you think that technologies like Twitter are kind of undermining our value of privacy? And if so, what do you think of the dangers of that?
I think Twitter is completely in the public. It's completely opt-in. There are no privacy controls. So if anything, I think it gives us more control over our privacy and what we want to put out in the world and what we want to view. You have to remember that everything that one puts out in Twitter is their choice. It is something that they choose to share with the world in real time, and also choose to consume from the world in real time. So, like I said before, these technologies have an understanding and evolution in how we use them. And I'm hoping that we can use Twitter in a way that enhances our privacy and enhances the need for a public and private discourse and, you know, where things make sense and where they don't.
Okay, if we have one more question, please.
Hi. And the protests in Moldova were credited with being a Twitter revolution. What does that do to your head when you read things like that?
Well, it's humbling, first of all. But it was very telling of what's important. And I think a lot of folks have focused on how many followers one has. But those protests happened because there was one man who had 20 followers, and he created a 5-character hashtag. And he used that to spread through the entire city and through the entire country. And that resulted in a massive grouping of individuals in the town square. So to have that sort of power, even with that few followers, is very inspiring. And it really shows like what you need to focus on. What you need to focus on is not getting the number of followers, but focus on producing amazing tweets and amazing content and really something that people want to share and want to engage with. The fact that people gathered in the town square was amazing, but even more conversation, and it inspired people who did not know what was happening in Moldova to learn. And the same thing happened in Iran a few months later, where, you know, in America, Iran is very much a black box and very, very poorly understood. But suddenly you were having people on the streets sharing pictures of what was happening on the street, sharing videos, sharing audio, and you could be there with them. And I've never had that experience before. It's hugely inspiring and humbling.
Okay, well, whatever about 140 characters, the nightmare for a broadcaster is interviewees who answer in 2 characters, no, or answer questions in 3 characters, yes. But delighted that Jack has been such a brilliant interviewee who's answered all the questions so fully. And I'd like to thank on your behalf, Jack Dorsey. Thank you very much.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Weekdays from 4:30. Today FM.